Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with the great Lenny Kay of the Patti Smith Group about his new book on 10 moments that changed rock and roll. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, we have new albums by Lucius and Warpaint to review. That is a track called Next to Normal from the fourth studio album from Lucius, Second Nature. A four-piece band, Lucius is, but the core is two women, Holly Lessig and Jess Wolf. They met at Berklee College of Music. They started releasing music in 2009. Their first full-length studio album came out at that time. Then, good grief, 2016. It's been a while to concoct this next record, this fourth studio record. They haven't been idle, though. I think Holly Lessig and Jess Wolf are two of the most in-demand backing vocalists of the last decade plus. They spent a goodly amount of time doing stadium tours with Roger Waters as backing vocalists.
We got to give their whole CV. Roger Waters, Sheryl Crow, Harry Styles, and Ozzy Osbourne.
Ozzy Osbourne, The War on Drugs, Brandy Carlile. I mean, the list goes on. Incredible, really. Here's the new record. We're going to play a track from it before we review it. It was produced by Dave Cobb, the Nashville Ace, and Brandy Carlile, so a couple of big names working on this one. It's called Second Nature. The track we're going to play is called Promises from Lucius on Sound Opinions.
That is Promises from the new Lucius album, Second Nature. There's kind of this, like, overly precious super muso mentality. I mean, you know, like, there's no way you can actually like, Harry Styles, Sheryl Crow, Ozzy Osbourne, and Roger Waters. I mean, these are gigs for hire. We're great musicians, we get hired. And there's a lot of that on this album. Now, there's also some humanity. You know, they said, Jess and Holly, that they wanted to make an album during COVID that was going to let them dance their way through the darkness.
Right.
That's something we've been saying many times in reviews over the last couple of months. We're going to say it again when we review the Warpaint album. This has been the goal. It seems like many musicians and many music lovers have been dancing around their living rooms while they were locked down as an effort to fight off all the bad thoughts of the last 2 years. When they are in up-tempo disco mode, Second Nature, Next to Normal, Dance Around It, which features Brandy Carlile and Sheryl Crow. It's good stuff. It's good mainstream pop with a little. It's like the indie group tries to make mainstream pop records, okay? But my God, there are some dreadful slow jams. 24 and Heartbursts and White Lies that are absolutely horrible. And then there's one song that's so bad that I thought at first it was a joke. LSD, which according to Holly and Jess stands for Love So Deep. all right, but has this goofy recurring line, "Hungry heart, follow me in the dark," which I kept mishearing. You know how you have those famous, you know, "Excuse me while I kiss this guy," yeah, for Hendrix. "Excuse me while I kiss this guy." I kept hearing it as "Hungry, follow me in like baloney." Which I prefer vastly to any of the lyrics they have. I wish it had been that line. I, you know, the bad parts are so bad that I could not enjoy the handful of good tracks.
Yeah, you know, I saw Lucius early on in their career, and I liked them live. They're dynamic. They're obviously super talented singers. There's a reason that all these people hire them to sing backing vocals. They're right on. They're ready. They're pros. They know what they're doing. But this record's a mess. You know, with Cobb and with Dave Cobb and Brandi Carlile producing, I thought this was going to be kind of a rootsy thing, you know? And it would have been a smart move for them because I think they've got that in them. What we got is sort of a glossy pop record. There's a lot of post-disco dance pop on this record. It sounds very generic to me.
Yeah.
Like anybody could have done this. Some of the tracks with a little more character, like 24, you didn't like that track.
No.
It's a little, you know, it's a little bit of an outlier. It's sort of a gothic chamber pop thing, you know? Counting the ways that this could all end. But I still sleep on my side of the bed, just leaving space for you. That song, Tears in Reverse, I go, there's a couple of really good songs in here, but they try to put them together, and it sounds like this Frankenstein thing. You know, there's a cool dark element in there, and then it's got this incongruous pop chorus, and you're just going, what is this? What's this supposed to be? I hate to hang this tag on anybody, but sort of like adult alternative radio format. Remember that kind of garbage, you know?
Yeah.
And this sort of...
Garbage, not garbage the band.
You know, it feels that way. Like it can't decide what it wants to be, so it's just going to be sort of this bland, homogenous, you know, a tune for every taste kind of thing, and it doesn't really work. They can't figure out who they want to be.
Well, you know, some people are just meant to be backing musicians.
I hate to say that, but this record sounds like that. I wish they would just make a record that's a little bit... They say it's a personal record, but it doesn't sound personal.
No.
It sounds very factory, you know, oriented.
That is a song called Champion that kicks off the first new album in seemingly forever from Warpaint. The record is called Radiate Like This. Greg, we have been big fans of Warpaint for quite some time. They were guests on the show, episode 444, in 2014. They have been around a long time. Four young women that first came together in 2009 with a debut EP that was mixed by the only good thing about the Red Hot Chili Peppers ever, psychedelic guitarist John Frusciante, proceeded to release a number of EPs and albums in the years that followed. This is only the fourth studio album. There's always been a big span of time between Warpaint records. This one took 6 years to come together, during which the musicians in Warpaint played with other people, including Phoebe Bridgers, Kurt Vile, Courtney Barnett, went through cross-country moves, childbirth, or as they said, babies, jobs, tours, solo albums, intercontinental and cross-country moves. Okay, mm-hmm. So they have been busy. You and I were both excited to see that they are back, the original quartet, and that this record was produced by Sam Pet Davies, who has worked with Tom York, Frank Ocean, and Skull Crusher. There's a diverse CV resume as well. So what do Warpaint give us now that they're back in the studio? Let's play this track, and then we'll come back and give our reviews. It is called Hips by Warpaint. Cruising through fire, it's shady weather. There's fear in the house. Gotta come up on the pressure.
That is Hips from War Paint, the new record Radiate Like This. You are right, Jim. We've been fans of this band for a while. You know, I'm thinking about what is it about them that makes them so different? They have a different feel to the way they approach things. They're ostensibly a rock band, guitars, bass, drums, but they're not drawing on, like, you know, the typical rock band influences. They don't sound like an indie rock band from the 80s, for example, or, you know, imitating classic rock sounds. They're influenced by R&B and hip-hop and trip-hop. In that sense, a more contemporary example might be like a band like the XX from England that was drawing on these kind of darker R&B vibes, which I thought was really cool. War Paint have been doing that for a lot longer than the XX have, and they've been doing it really well. The one thing about this record is it's not as immediate as the previous couple of records. There's nothing as immediate as like Disco Very from the self-titled 2014 album, or New Song from Heads Up, which was their previous record. There was some thought that they were actually going to break up after that record. You know, they got done touring that record, but they, you know, they've had this 20-year partnership, and they all write and they all collaborate together, and nothing quite sounds like they do. Yeah. The four of them, you know, together. Even though they made this album sort of piecemeal, it's got a sort of a layered feel to it. I think the choice of the producer, the Sam Petz Davies, was an interesting choice. You know, grab this and put it on with a bottle of Amarone, and you're set for a chill out mode, like nobody's business. It is a chill out record. It's, as I said, not as immediate, but at the same time, it does draw you into their world, and it does have that feel of like a really cool, low-key R&B record with some hip-hop influences in it. Again, nothing else quite sounds like them.
No, and it does surround you. You're right about that. You know, the lyric in Champion, the ocean breathes in and out. It's a million years old. And it seems as if War Paint's been with us a long time. You can completely submerge yourself in their sounds. I said when we were reviewing Lucius, it seems like so many artists were making dance records to transcend the darkness of the COVID period. I like this album best when it's in dance mode. Champion, Hips. I am a little less enthralled with the slower tracks. Hard to tell
those are the sensual ones. Come on.
Send nudes. Yeah, okay.
Send a couple nudes, baby.
What gets me excited most about War Paint is I am a super geek fan of drummer Stella Mozgova.
Yeah, she's all right? great.
I think short of Philip Selway in Radiohead, no one in the last 25 years in rock has done a better job of incorporating electronics with acoustic drumming and an awareness of hip-hop, of avant-garde electronica, of classic rock grooves. I mean, she is just a wonder, you know. And there's less of the acoustic drums here, but every single groove, slow ones and dance groovers alike, are pure Stella. And for that, I love it, even the slow songs.
Yep. So we're pretty enthusiastic about this War Paint record, not so much with the Lucius. Give us your thoughts on those two albums. Leave your review in a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, we're going to talk with Lenny Kaye about his latest book. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. Lenny Kaye, I'd wager to say, Greg, is a name that most of our listeners have heard in one way or another for the past, let's face it, half a century. As the guitarist accompanying the Patti Smith Band, as a groundbreaking, a pioneer in the field of rock criticism, rock historian, as an A&R guy, right? He put together the Immortal Nuggets box set that defined psychedelic garage rock. Lenny is a man of many talents, and I've always been honored to speak to him. We did long interviews for the Lester Bangs book that I wrote in 2000, and about the Nuggets for my psychedelic book. And he's just always a pleasure to talk to, isn't he?
He absolutely is. I mean, he's such a wide-ranging guy. His knowledge of music is probably as deep as anyone I have ever talked to. And I think when I say music, I mean all kinds of music.
Yeah, and
I mean,
never lost the passion. Never.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's still digging, still finding stuff, still curious about the world. He's produced albums in addition for Suzanne Vega, Kristen Hirsch, Soul Asylum. He's written about music for lots of outlets, and he's the author of 4 books. Today we're going to talk with him about his latest book, Lightning Strikes, 10 Transformative Moments in Rock and Roll.
I just thought this is a way to not only tell these tales, which we all know too well, but also to kind of tell them in the present tense, so that you're actually in the studio with Elvis or on the stage of the Cavern with the Beatles, and how it felt most importantly to be in the audience, because these scenes are not like just, you know, people playing to nowhere. They how they grow and how they become their own definition and kind of step along the evolutionary trail of rock and roll. It's a connected story. Basically, it's the long view and then really the you are there short view.
Yeah. Story that began before the book, story that continues after the book. I want to ask an even more basic question, Lenny. What is rock and roll? At some point in the book, you say, if pressed to define it, I could. And then you move on without defining it. I ask because the last time you and I spoke, it's actually been quite a while, I interviewed you for my biography of Lester Bangs.
All right.
And as a 17-year-old kid, I asked Lester, what is rock and roll? How do you define that, right? And I was shocked that it took him several minutes of silence, and he really considered before he gave me his definition. And his definition was that, you know, it could be a lot of things. It's Charlie Mingus, it's Hank Williams, it's an attitude. It's something that makes you feel alive. So in these times, you've been lucky, despite your first decade pretty much being part of the rock crit, rock journalist establishment, right? You've done something else in between. I forget what it was. But now you're back in it, right? So there's this horrible debate that's gone on in music writing for the last 20 years, rockism versus popism. And rock and roll is a loaded word, right? It says you're wed to the guitar, that good music can't be made with turntables or samplers, right? All this nonsense has been laid on it. But at its heart, what is this thing you've devoted your life to? What is rock and roll?
Well, I'm not a person who likes definitions. I remember the aphorism I took off the rear of a Red Crayola record in the 60s. Mayo Thompson said, definitions define limit. And so, yeah, you can make anything into rock and roll. My version of it, somewhat guitar, as seen through my particular eyes. I mean, it's very guitar-centric. It got defined. I mean, I believe Alan Freed, you know, in the prologue chapter kind of defined it. So it was different than the jump blues and the country boogie that would go into the alchemical moment when Elvis is in Sun Records and Sam Phillips says, "It's alive, it's alive."
yeah.
I mean, you know, rock and roll has so many borders. There's a rock and roll sensibility, just like there's a punk sensibility, you know, of the groups that were gathered around CBGB in the 70s, they had a punk sensibility. When it got to England and got a very defined look and style, then it was punk defined, which sometimes is as limiting as it is able to have its own bin somewhere in the Universal Record Store. You know, I mean, everybody brings their own interpretation. Is hip hop rock and roll? Well, it's called hip hop, so it's you're getting out of the genre. Is rock and roll pop? Yes, but is all pop music rock and roll? No. It's a way that we handily classify our musics in the same way that jazz, you know, could be Duke Ellington, it could be bebop, it could be Albert Eiler. I believe we all contain multitudes, and however you define who you'd like to be, that's who you are.
Yeah. Jazz could be certain tracks by the MC5.
Absolutely.
You know, I love it when you bring yourself into the narrative, specific to the Beatles. You're 17 and you see them on Sullivan.
Yeah, at, just you know, 17. And that seems to be... I knew what they mean.
Yeah. And you when you talk about what your definition of rock is, that seemed to be a defining moment for the combo, the thing that you knew as rock and roll.
I mean, but also I grew up in Brooklyn, so my original rock and roll was seeing the older kids on the corner hitting notes, as we used to say, you know, give me an A, hey, hey. I used to have a falsetto. Rock and roll, my vision of it changed when I went to San Francisco and saw the improvisations and the kind of spatial expanse of the music played by the Grateful Dead and Big Brother and Quicksilver. I didn't want to write a memoir. I don't really care that much about my own history, to be honest. You know, what I had for dinner on a Tuesday in 1973. What I cared about is how the music affected, influenced, and inspired me, and how the music evolved within itself. These are generations in the book.
I always thought that rock and roll was kind of a mutt to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, what's the pure rock and roll? And some people would say, well, you know, rock and roll ended when Buddy Holly died or something, or, you know, Elvis went to the army, or
yeah.
If you didn't hear see those the kind Beatles, of things. And I go, you missed it all.
But to me, the beautiful thing about rock music and rock and roll, you know, I guess it's important too, whether you put the roll or is it just the rock? Or what,
exactly.
You know, it has always been morphing. It always seemed to like, whatever was currency, it incorporated it into it, and it'll always keep on living in some shape. Maybe the electric guitar won't necessarily be at the center of it, but I always think there's going to be something there that expresses that
feeling. I'm sure there is. I mean, I'm sure elements of it will morph and mutate and mongrelize into the next musics, but I haven't really heard over the past 20 years any rock-oriented band doing something that I haven't heard twice before. You know, once is the original conception and the other next is the revival. And so I don't think this is even a bad thing or even pejorative in terms of rock and roll. I just think the form has understood itself. If it's that kind of evolution, it'll be another music. And I like to hear these things, but again, a music moves from innovation to interpretation. And I think that's the kind of the part of rock and roll that we're in at this moment in time. If you go back 100 years to 1920, things really changed. The last of the 19th century was gone, and you suddenly had radio, you had, acoustic recording moving to electrical. And the sounds and the shapes of the records and the way people perceived, you know, I mean, the 3 minute single, the 3 minute song is because 78s only has 3 minutes on each side. So
it's all the medium could accommodate.
So, I mean, I think with all the new digital tools and manipulations and ways in which you can, maybe even this very second somewhere in someone's basement, you know, I mean, I'm waiting for guitar modelers, you know, the thing which you plug your guitar and you can sound like a Marshall or a Fender or a Stratocaster or whatever. I'm waiting until you don't have to worry that you sound like a 20th century amplifier or guitar, that you can sound like something different. This is the future, and, you know, bring it on.
Be yourself and do it. Right? This is the era where everybody creates. I mean,
absolutely.
You were part of the greatest inspirational, you know, I mean, if that guy was a writer, right? He was a record store clerk. He's on stage now with one of the most galvanizing female vocalists ever. You know, he's a rock star. How'd that happen? Lenny Kaye, rock star? That's not supposed to happen.
I've always been a musician and a writer. When I was in the 60s, I had my college bands, the Zoo, where, we play fraternity parties for 4 hours straight. So I actually kind of learned one of my trades. And I also, you know, majored in American cultural history. So I also learned my other trade. I don't feel that there's like a difference between my writerly personality and my musicianly personality, because I do feel within a sentence, there's melody and rhythm. And in a guitar solo, there's a narrative arc. and hopefully they all come together somewhere in this wacky brain of mine. You know, a lot of writers who play, they think about it too much. You know, it's more self-conscious. I'm not really self-conscious at all. I'm just trying not to hit the next clam. And, you know, a lot of these out of the way places like CBGB's, that's kind of where the cauldron, where you could understand who you were. It's where with Patty, you know, even though we were playing for about a year and a half before then, when we played 7 weeks in a row at CB's with television, four nights a week, we really were able to dig deeply into what it was we're doing. And when we came out of there, that trial by fire, we understood each other. And if we suddenly thought, oh man, you know, we've written a song in a practice room, let's go to the record companies immediately, you know, we would have sounded like everybody else.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
You know, it's interesting that you titled each chapter after a particular location as opposed to a band or an artist. And obviously, scenes. You mentioned that you used that word just now, scenes, which to me is like another way of saying community.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What's the thread there? What's the common thread in those scenes?
The thread, I have to say, I didn't invent the term, but Brian Eno did. It's called scenius, where it's not the geniuses, it's not just the Beatles, it's not just the Grateful Dead or the Jefferson Airplane. It's the whole ecology of these people gathering together and inspiring each other, the audience looking at the band looking at the audience, the club, the musics that they're bringing to the table. I mean, that to me is what makes a scene. And I mean, you know, there's lots of great ones. I always wish I would have been in West 52nd Street in 1947 to walk down that street past the Three Deuces and the Famous Door and all those incredible clubs and hang out and feel the excitement of this new form of jazz suddenly being created. And that's, you know, I mean, I could see that in San Francisco, CBGB, you know, the metal chapter, I'm sure the Sunset Strip in 1983, you know, with all those, you know, party animals, that was an exciting place to be, Seattle, you know, and sometimes it's unexpected. There were places I kind of wished I could include in the book, even though my magnum opus would have been more magnumanious. I would have liked to have, you know, gone to Athens, Georgia in the mid-80s. Minneapolis was another one, or Manchester in the 90s, the trip-hop 90s, or, you know, who knows? I mean, basically, you know, you're dealing with things happening. And it's not just the people on stage, which is how the tale is really told. It's the social climate. It's where the city is in terms of discovering itself or coming back, like Detroit, you know, which had really a rough 1968. And out of that thing, you know, you have bands like the Stooges and the MC5 really addressing the, quote, American come down. As the compilation series Brown Acid says.
Well, and one of the wonderful things about your approach, Lenny, is that it's not about putting the geniuses of rock and roll, you know, on a pedestal. You know, people are going to be surprised when they get to Liverpool and read your take on the Beatles. You know, there's a lot of Billy Fury and a lot of Joe Meek in that chapter, right? And they were geniuses too.
They contributed to what British rock and roll was able to become, its own unique beast, not just kind of a pale shadow of American rock and roll. And yeah, I mean, I had more fun going into the universe of Rory Storm and finding out who he was. And, you know, I've always loved Joe Meek, as crazy as he is. Again, you're dealing with an entire an entire social universe happening kind of on its own. I mean, Liverpool was in the British Isles, Nowheresville, except, you know, that's where the ships came in and they were carrying, carrying American 45s, but, you know, might've been on Mars.
Well, so no surprise in that chapter, but Oslo. Oslo's the one. Lenny Kay is a fan of death metal?
Yeah, well, you know, I like to bang my head. I mean, that was the most extreme. I mean, I always knew the story, how crazy it was, the church burnings and the murders. But to actually get under its skin and see how it happened in a country that is so really non-threatening in a certain way. But, you know, what can I say? It was a great trip. It was a very localized scene. I mean, I could have probably, you know, brought in Sweden or Denmark. The bands were there, but Oslo seemed the craziest of all of them. And what I was looking for basically was times and places that were very, very gritty, that had their own story. You know, again, I like the metal chapter. I kind of, you know, after all the heavy ones, it was fun to do. It was fun to get into the wackiness that was Los Angeles in the early 80s, the hair metal years, and Norway. And you got to say, once you get into them, there's a lot of fantastic records that come out of there, you know. Season to Taste, but Mayhem's Freezing Moon is a great slab of aggression, I have to say. Oh my God.
Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation with Lenny Kay. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. And we're back. We're talking with legendary guitarist, producer, and music writer Lenny Kay. Let's get back into the conversation. Yeah, I'm interested too. You focus on Philadelphia, 1959, American Bandstand, Dick Clark. You know, I was interested the way the audience being such an essential part of that dynamic that was happening. You know, kids seeing themselves on screen, not only in the bands what they were singing about, but in the audience seeing the bands, and then there's an audience watching the audience. And the racial filtering that's going on there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who is that audience? Even though it's largely a black art form that they're witnessing being performed, whether it's by actual African-Americans or by white people imitating African-Americans. And I guess it's incredible to me that this art form was forged in this era of civil rights. Like, it's always, to me, like, been one of the great stories about rock and roll is how important it was in sort of breaking down those barriers before any other part of society was ready for it.
You know, music will do that. I mean, I find it very synchronous that Elvis in July of 54 is recording 2 months after Brown versus the Board of Education decision, which effectively, you know, denied segregation in the school system of the South. But, you know, nothing happens overnight. I mean, obviously, we're still dealing with racial divide. You know, what can one say? It's a tragedy because we're talking about different skin colors, for crying out loud. I mean, this is, and different, of course, lines of generational cultures. But American Bandstand, more than the racial thing, to me, it kind of sealed this teenage fascination that rock and roll would have.
Mickey Gabriel, 18.
Okay, the song is by Fats Domino. It's fast. If you'll take that side, you folks take the middle. Here's the big beat.
You know, most of the early rock and rollers were not particularly teenage. You know, so as the hit parade turned more adolescent in a time when adolescence suddenly became a thing. You know, Frank Sinatra had teenage fans, but he was singing an adult music. But all of a sudden the teens had their own channel, their own idols, and their own television show to tell them more about how to dress and how to comport themselves and how to clap out of rhythm, and all those things like that. And of course, Dick Clark is a pretty interesting story because he did bring it to the world, and he was not without sin, as they say, but it's part of rock and roll's trajectory. And often Philadelphia is kind of leaped over because it's not as cool, man, as like New Orleans or the Beatles or whatever. But really, when I was in the sweet spot of pre-adolescence, I mean, I was 11 at the time, 10. That was my conduit to rock and roll. I was too young to go to even a Alan Freed show or Murray the K. You know, I was at home. So the first time I got to see Duane Eddy play guitar or Eddie Cochran or any of those was on American Bandstand. And I felt mm-hmm. a sense of identity and belonging with the peer group that I hope to join in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, MTV did much the same in the 90s, you know. My daughters would come rushing home from school to, you know, turn that on and see, you know, that was their pop radio. It had the same kind of impact on them as well.
No, it's a time when you're really like a sponge. You're absorbing all these influences and also wanting to define you as opposed to your parents or even your older brothers or sisters. So it's nice to have a sense of identity to, you know, this is my gang. And, you know, more power to it. I remember driving with my daughter when she was about 9 or 10 or something. And anytime a song with a guitar would come on it, she'd punch the radio. You know, okay.
No.
You know, what can I, or when I, you know, I mean, you got to separate. I took her to her first concert. I believe it was No Doubt at Tramps. And, you know, I'm standing there and I like to think I'm not uncool, but yeah, she's like 20 feet away.
Yeah.
Doing her own thing and Lord love her.
Is that Rylan and Emmett, the book is dedicated to that. Is that, those are your
my grand twins. Yeah.
Grand twins.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about that, Lenny. I've never gotten the sense whether I was going back my first book about psychedelic rock and reading about where Nuggets came from and the writing you'd done about those bands or, you know, Patty writing in Cream about the Rolling Stones. What that piece is one of the mm-hmm. greatest pieces of rock writing ever. There seemed to be more of a synergy in the first generation of music journalists and critics with the musicians. There was less of that, you know, you're over here, we're over there. When you were writing this magnum opus of yours, were you keeping in mind Rylan and Emmett, granddaughters, a different generation? Our associate producer, you know, Sol Delgadillo's in her 20s, right? Are you writing for them as well as all the old farts like us who are just going to read this for nostalgia?
Well, first of all, I don't really believe in music as nostalgia. I don't have any nostalgia when I hear Be My Baby on the radio. I don't think, oh man, I was like, you know. I hear
it's alive in the here and now, and same way that
I don't even have, I don't have a nostalgia when I'm listening to a Robert Johnson record.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I have a nostalgia for, you know, a couple of songs that,
yeah,
but you know, you don't know who you're writing it for. I you know, I have fascinations too. Obviously, I mean, I've done a lot of deep reading into, you know, say bebop when I actually figured out how to listen to it, which took me many, many years. It wasn't just Charlie Parker's great, and I needed the key. And my key was Dodo Marmarosa, the wacky piano player who pushed the piano out the window to see what it sounded like when it. Great guy. But, you know, I mean, I wrote it for, you know, yeah, maybe Rylan and Emmett, you know, because when I go to visit them, they want to rock and roll. We put on AC/DC mm-hmm. and we bang our heads around the, I like rock and roll. Okay. You know, but maybe they'll want to learn about it in the same way that I wanted to learn about Chopin when I was working on my crooner book and kind of got in that particular tangent. Music books are there to illuminate, and you know, I'm not really writing it for us, even though we'll get some amusement because we've seen the arc of the music that I'm working on. But really, I'm writing it for anybody who might come there who doesn't really know anything about it. I'm trying to write it in a way that's accessible and draws you in and gives you a lot of detail and a lot of background information, and you can pick and choose from it. I mean, I would love it if Rylan and Emmett read the book in 15 years and went mm-hmm. to Gampy's record collection and took out, Baby Metal and said, whoa, check this, give me chocolate. Who knows? I mean, I've been pointed in directions my whole life. It's so great to have a guide into it. When I was deeply learning about reggae in the 70s, I had a lot of mentors where I would learn about them and access how the music meant to me. And I would hope that perhaps somebody reading this book who doesn't really know that much about rock and roll is charmed. As I have been.
Or that mm-hmm. they catch the passion you had.
Well, that's the truth. And I feel passion and the gratefulness and the fact that I get up each morning and I can play any number of the instruments here in the basement, or I can go up to the record collection and try to find a record that I've lost months ago and still buried, and then find something else. It's really kind of... I call it at play in the fields of the Lord. And that's what I like to do. And sometimes you can figure out a concept to do it. I did that with my crooner book, You Call It Madness, where I got interested in this strange singer named Russ Colombo. This was before the internet. So I'm driving along. I hear his story about how he's killed by a dueling pistol from his best friend. And, his mother had a heart attack. So they couldn't tell her he died. So for 10 years, they wrote letters. And I thought, who is this guy? And if I would have gone on the internet the next day, I probably would have said, oh, that's interesting. I forgot about it. But I couldn't. So I started mm-hmm. going to old magazines and newspapers and the public library. And all of a sudden a universe opened to me. So maybe, somebody who's really interested in, any of the minor characters in the book will kind of start investigating and find a world of music awaiting them.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned earlier, we're talking about guitar playing sort of being, not overthinking it. And it strikes me that every moment in this book that you write about, this lightning striking moment that occurred in these cities, was unselfconscious. Yeah. It couldn't have been planned. It couldn't have been predicted.
Because as it becomes self-conscious, it becomes hardened into its stereotype. Yeah. Seattle, where if you listen to the early bands, especially Soundgarden, who I must say I've underestimated for years, and to actually listen to what they did in their early years, you really see that there's a lot of different kinds of approaches to the music. And over the course of a year, two, whatever, it coagulates into a thing. And when it becomes a thing, then it kind of excludes all the other musics that might be feeding into it. And happening at the same time. So, and then it becomes a stereotype, and then it's time to move on.
Mm-hmm. So, it becomes a marketing category.
I like the moments before it figures itself out. That's
before
when
the rules are codified.
Exactly.
And this is a difficult question, but you're probably the most qualified person I know to answer it, is what's the common thread? I'd asked you that earlier about those scenes. What is it about that lightning striking moment that you saw, like, there's something here, this is the elements that have to be in place in order for that to happen?
I think it's yearning. I think it's desire and yearning to find who you might be. I can only say that when I was a wild animal growing up in New Jersey, I don't know who I was. I wasn't a sports guy. I really wasn't that intellectual. I wasn't, collegiate, as they used to say. I was kind mm-hmm. of a mutant out there. And when I found rock and roll and started picking up the guitar, and I'm certainly not a virtuoso by any means, but I found in hitting that guitar, the chord, I found it struck a chord in me. And I wanted to be a part of it. I didn't know how, why, or how it would even reveal. And actually, I'm astonished how it revealed, because I didn't expect it. But I just believe that desire, and to invent yourself too. I mean, I remember, I think I even mentioned this in the book, in the early 80s when I lived across the street, catty corner from CBGB, and I would sit on my fire escape and watch the kids line up for Hardcore Sunday. And certainly was of my generation. And sometimes I'd go and watch them, wreak havoc in the joint. But they didn't know about before. They wanted to make their future. And to me, that's what all of these moments in time and space have in common, is that they've moved past it. They don't want to be the previous generation. They want to make their mark. And a lot of times that is very reactive to what the previous generation was. If you have the Bacchanal, that's Los Angeles in 1983, everybody dressed to the nines, glitter, complete, buffet of partying. Well, you're going to have, the next step will be the more down to earth, somewhat dour Seattle scene, where it brings it back to what I call the original sin. Okay, let's start from scratch. I'm sure will sound a lot like what came before. The Sex Pistols really sounded a lot like the Small Faces and the Who. Even though they were completely new and everything, but truly it's evolution. And I like when things change. I don't want to be trapped in music was either better then, or it was different, or it was real, or whatever. It's always in a state of flux. And I like that, because when things start changing, you start changing.
This book does bring that music to life.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. I loved writing it. About 2-3 years ago, I looked at how much I had left, because I thought each chapter, oh, yeah, I know this stuff. Yeah. I figured 2 months a chapter. Well, no, because once I started immersing myself in each scene, learning its minor characters, seeing how it all fit together, each chapter maybe took me about 6 months.
I have to say, thank you for this book. It was incredibly enjoyable read, and I expected nothing less from the man who gave me the Nuggets liner notes. That set me down a path that I've regretted ever since, but I have to say, I'm a writer in part because of that. Like, wow, you can put all these different things together in one place and make sense of it all, because I don't think anybody paid attention to those bands until then.
Well, I was just feeling my way in the dark personally. Rhino is going to do a 5-LP box set for the fall November Black Friday day. We've just been talking about it. But what I think about Nuggets, and why in a weird way it's lasted all these years, is because all the records there are not just garage records. They're great records.
Right.
They're really good listening. Come over to my house, man, here is a hot record, and then maybe I'll follow it with a great girl group record that's beyond the concept of a girl group. That's just a really great record. I like great records of any genre. I found them in the Oslo chapter. I didn't ever listen to Mayhem or Dark Throne or any of those lunatics, but, I found, wow, this is a great record. Soundgarden, whoa. What they're doing time-wise with the drums, it's crazy. And I don't know, I just really enjoy the exploration. And I'm going to keep exploring. I don't know if I'll do another magnum opus about it. I feel a little tired.
Yeah. Well, you get a break after this one.
Push that pen around. That's a work.
A little bit of a break, but then you'll get the itch again.
We've been talking to Lenny Kaye about his great book, Lightning Striking, 10 Transformative Moments in Rock and Roll. Lenny, thanks for being on the show.
Greg, thank you. Jim, old friend, thank you. And, let's hopefully we'll all get to headbang sometime in the near future.
Yeah, that would be fun. I want to go to Oslo now.
Yeah, now we're now we got
a really good
trip there.
That wraps up our conversation, and now we want to hear from you. Do you have any thoughts on Lenny Kaye's multifaceted career? Have you read the new book? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Greg, what's on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, 50th anniversary of one of the greatest albums of all time, Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones. We're going to do a deep dive in it, a classic album dissection.
Man, can't get enough of that record still. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our social media consultant is Katie Cobb.